Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. The last holiday week of 2025.
The last week of 2025.
Yeah, we're here. Well, you're here till through Friday, although you'll be off. We'll both be off Thursday. I'm heading to Las Vegas very early Friday morning to not sit in the sun.
Because spend all that holiday cash you got?
Yeah, well, hopefully win some more cash.
Wait, is it not warm in Vegas right
now? No, it's in the 50s, which is...
Well, it's warmer than it is here.
Yeah, it'll feel warm. Like, I've told the story many times. We go to Vegas in the winter and it's 50. I'm like walking around with a t-shirt on.
Yeah.
And they're like bundled. They're bundled with like, you know, coats and hats. It's a different perspective, but it's part of my 2026 plan to get out of this crappy weather at least once a month.
Which you basically have set up so far, because you're going, where are you going in February?
I'm going to Cancun, Mexico with our lovely listener group from Fox World Travel.
Then you're going to Egypt in March.
Egypt, Kathy and I, nice two-week cruise down the Nile.
Are you going anywhere in April?
April looks like Vegas again. Yeah.
May?
I think May's open.
So all right.
Entertaining options for May, and then June, I think I'm in the Caribbean for a while, and then...
All right, should we open it up? Because I'm taking suggestions on... guest co-hosts for all of Steve's vacations.
Yes.
So if you have thoughts on someone you'd like to come sit in with me while Steve is out, 855-616-1620.
Open
to recommendations.
I look forward to seeing those names because if you listen to WTMJ, and I know this is a point of contention for some people, there's a lot of people out this week. You know,
there is a lot of people out this week. But
Jessica's out.
Both John and Julia are out.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, I mean... That's an interesting topic, and this is not to throw any of our teammates under the bus, but it's you know, we think about service industry people, we think about people who work in retail, and some jobs where you don't always get the holidays off. Firemen,
mm-hmm.
policemen, ER doctors, like there's a lot of people, there's a lot of jobs where you don't necessarily get the holidays off, and you know, we have some flexibility. Obviously, some people can take it off, but as I said to you this morning, I think our Christmas Eve show was one of the most fun shows you and I ever did.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that we're lucky enough that we don't have to travel far for family and that we were able to do Rapids over the weekends with my parents, but otherwise we stayed down here. And so to come in, do a two-hour show with you, and then we went to Swinging Door, which I think is the new family tradition.
Yeah, so I...
Do the 10 to 12 show on Christmas Eve. Mike picks me up with Frankie, and then the three of us go get some... lunch at Swinging Door, one of the few restaurants that was open on Christmas Eve for lunch.
Yeah, also, it's a great local restaurant, too.
Great local
restaurant.
Right
down the street on Michigan here from our studios here at the Avenue in downtown Milwaukee. We thought we'd spend a little, as we did last week, this week's show is going to be a little bit different, but there's a lot of big news stories that I think we have to just refresh
on. We missed
on.
Some huge news stories last week.
Yeah.
I mean, we just basically avoided altogether
right.
the 60 Minutes CBS punt.
Right.
That was, I mean, we missed a lot of things. There was Epstein news last week. We're going to start with the CBS Barry Weiss fiasco. What's going on in Minnesota? Like, just because it's the holidays doesn't mean that the news apparently, no one else, the news doesn't stop. So I'm sure everyone knows this by now because it was news from last week. But 60 Minutes on what would have been the 19th?
Yeah.
No, what was that Sunday?
The Sunday before Christmas.
So... I can't do math right now as far as what that... Well, the Sunday before Christmas, there was supposed to be an already approved, ready-to-air, legal, had signed off on it, segment on CECOT. So where the 400 Venezuelan immigrants were sent by our government.
It's in El Salvador.
To El Salvador.
The real name is the Terrorism Confinement Center. The president has used this as sort of a portal to send people out of our country to other countries as sort of the ICE next phase or whatever you want to call
it. Yeah. And at the 11th hour, Barry Weiss, the new editor-in-chief at CBS News, said it wasn't ready to air and basically said we need to have more on-camera interviews with White House officials who had already had the opportunity to weigh in and give comment, and they had refused to comment for weeks. And I am not a journalist, but apparently Barry Weiss is not a journalist either, because that is the whole point. It's like you give people the time to respond to the article that you're going to print, and if they don't respond, that is their response. And so you can't just inevitably hold a story because you don't have comment from everyone involved in the story. They're choosing not to give comment, and that is part of the story that is baked in. And so it's just, and I just, it's wild to me because her having this job is basically like you and I running the Journal Sentinel.
Right.
Right? Like you and I are very clear about the fact that we are not journalists. We are not trained as journalists. We have a lot of respect for what journalists do, but we, what our jobs is, whether it's me writing or us doing this show or making social media commentary, is commenting on the reporting that actual reporters do. And Barry Weiss came up through opinion. Like, she has never been a reporter. She has always been someone who has come from the analysis, punditry.
She wrote op-eds for the New York Times.
Yeah, and it's not that she doesn't have a resume as far as writing for incredibly large publications, but it is not the rigor of what good reporting is. And so it is wild to me, and wild to a lot of people, that like she has basically just been put in there to be a suck up to the Trump administration.
Yeah, basically she's doing the bidding of the Trump administration. The owner of Paramount, that's David Ellison, mega, you know, billionaire beyond, who's buying up things all over the place. And we're seeing a buyout of all of these major media institutions by very few men to try to, I think, control the messaging. And I think this is really dangerous. But here's, CBS has always, for me, been the standard of news. Whether you're talking about 60 Minutes in the days of the Mike Wallaces and all the great journalists they had there, even their evening news program was always something that I looked up to and watched when I could. I think when you erode, first of all, we've seen the erosion of news overall. I can't tell you how many young people I talk to, and they get their news on Twitter. They tell me that first and foremost, I get my news on Twitter.
Bookmark that, because I want to come back to that point in an interesting conversation that I listened to over the weekend between Tim Miller and Kara Swisher. But I don't want to cut you off, so we'll come back to that.
So that was the first phase of like blowing up the public's trust in media. The second phase is you basically have media organizations who are doing the bidding of this current president and his administration. And where are we going to get some solid information, not only on what's happening, but as far as the illegalities that may or may not be happening in any administration, this one or the one that comes next or the one that comes after that? Once you've destroyed that trust, it's impossible to get it back. You have a non-journalist leading what I think is used to be one of the most high integrity, high standard offices in news, CBS, that did tremendous reporting on things like the dangers of cigarette smoking and the dangers of cancer and related industries that sort of were making that problem worse. Medical care, the lack of medical care, all those great stories they did. And now we're pulling stories because they're uncomfortable to this administration. That's a troubling trend that I don't like.
Except not pulling them entirely, because it's still aired
in Canada.
And thus made it onto the internet, and now people have actually been able to see what was in the segment, because she did not fully understand that just because you pulled it in the U.S. doesn't mean it's not going to air other places. Did you watch it?
I've seen half of it.
I've seen the clips,
basically.
Pretty bad.
It's horrible. It's good reporting. I thought it was
great reporting. But yeah, as far as what we subjected people who were not even, were not criminals to, as far as that kind of abuse, I do not think we will look back 5 to 10 years from now and look kindly on that.
Yeah, and not to, because I know we're late for break. This reporting is important because years from now, the treatment of individuals who are deported without due process, which is still the law of the land, and what happens to these people and their families is going to be a news story for the next decade and beyond. So not having accurate reporting, journalists doing their very hard job to tell us what the facts of the case are. I'm sorry, I don't trust internet journalists. And we're going to get to a story in a little bit about that.
I want to talk about next. The difference between being in a news desert versus a news flood.
Yeah.
And which one's worse. Let's talk about that on the other side of this.
Lots to talk about on this Monday. Thanks for tuning in. You can find us always here on 620 WTMJ or wherever you get your news. And WTMJ.com is a great source to that as well. Lots more coming up. Gen 19 here at 620 WTMJ, the Avenue Studios. Kristen Bry alongside, as she always is, here on Point Taken.
All right, so I wanted to get your thoughts on this, which is not necessarily to deal with any of the news stories that we're going to talk about today, but I was listening to The Bulwark, as I often do as my roundup when I have time to listen to podcasts. And Tim Miller had Kara Swisher on, and I know how much you love Kara Swisher, as do I. And he made the same comment that you just did as far as where people are getting their news from, as far as I'm getting from TikTok or Instagram or Twitter. And he indicate like he implies that it's a bad thing. And she stops him. She goes, yeah, but they weren't getting news at all anymore before that. And she goes, these weren't people who were seeking out news from, you know, articles or local news or stuff like that. He's like, it's a lot of people who, and she like, and she made this statement of going from a news desert to a news flood isn't necessarily a good thing. In fact, she thinks floods are often much more damaging than droughts. And I wondered what you thought of that. Do you think it's better or worse as far as people having so much access to information that isn't always vetted versus less information at all?
Yeah, I'm going to use an old term, gatekeepers. There's no gatekeepers on the flood of information that flows out on social media now, TikTok, Twitter, whatever, even Facebook to some degree, because we utilize Facebook here at 620 WTMJ. There's no gatekeepers that tell us what's real and what's not. And I understand that now this everything is through the political partisan lens. So you could have something happen, and both sides could see that and perceive it in a much different way. Both sides think that's the facts of the case.
So that's what I'm asking you. Do you think it's, what's worse? Less information? People who are in a news desert or having a drought and not getting the news at all versus the flood of news and people getting it from unvetted sources on social media?
It may sound even more dangerous, but less, because I think the damage that this flood is causing is there's so many like just bizarre and conspiracy laced ideas that are sort of passing along as people are passing along as fact that just have just polluted our environment. So
the latter, you agree with Kara Swisher that the latter is worse?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
I think I do too.
Yeah. Another texter says the unvetted is another, you know, obviously a word you could use. I just don't know at this moment in time with the arrival of the Barry Weisses who are serving in a news role and they're not really news people or journalists, having a lot of responsibility, a lot of oversight over what traditionally has been. Look, you can say whatever you want about 60 Minutes, and I know that some Republicans don't like it anymore. That was the standard for decades. Heavily vetted, researched. They spent sometimes months on one story that maybe lasted 10 to 12 minutes. With the best journalists in the land. And those people, some of them are still around in some capacity doing some other things. Most of them probably podcasts or blogs, if that's still a thing.
Substack.
Substack, which I've avoided because I've already got enough things to think
check.
About. Yeah. I worry long term about the word fact because it's polluted now. And whether it's the moon launch or the earth being round, or I mean, those are some extreme examples, but you know, whether vaccines are actually a good thing, because that's heavily debated now, which just astounds me given what I know about the medical records for the last 100 years in this country, which have we sort of eliminated many diseases and illness that persisted for centuries before that, when people started congregating in cities and they all died because somebody got, you know, smallpox or measles or whatever. It astounds me that somebody wants to make that case going forward that we don't need vaccine programs. And that seems to be, in one extreme example, where we're going. The absence of facts in these news stories just drives me nuts. But we have whole networks that devoted to that now, where it's a political lean. I don't like political radio that has one side featured over the other. That's why we try to balance our coverage as much as we can in today's, you know, non-fact world. It bothers me. And maybe that's the old man in me that, you know, grew up. I actually have a degree in broadcast journalism, so I went to school for that in mass comm, presenting that information in sort of an acceptable way. And back then, I would say the journalist schools probably do a much better job than we did back then, because it was like we were playing news host for some of our education back at UWM, great school, but that's what we did. I worry about the absence of facts. And I think as we approach 2026, we're going to try to stay on the facts. So maybe we have to fill that void. And I'm happy filling it. And maybe that should be our gold standard for next year. She's Chris and I'm Steve. Point taken. We'll wrap the first half hour. Busy show today. We have Dave Spano coming up in the 11 o'clock hour, as he always does, and our friend Alex Strove to sort of dissect what in the hell was going on.
I didn't
out
even
there.
Text you.
Oh, my goodness.
Did you cry?
I didn't cry, but I came close.
Quick did you break your TV?
I didn't break my TV.
Once they've swallowed sham and hokum, facts and logic won't unchoke them. They'll go on believing what they want to. Show them exactly what's the score. They'll just believe it even more.
I can't place who this is.
I can't place what song this is, right, but Jess, I'm interested.
It's from Wicked for Good.
Oh, the
oh
new
is
movie.
It a new song?
I mean, I think it was in the original Wicked.
I don't think this is in the original Wicked.
Well, it is Jeff Goldblum, so.
Yeah, it's definitely not in the original Wicked, where I was like, why do I know this voice? But I also haven't seen the new Wicked, which is shocking for me.
What is the context of this song in the movie? Because it's talking about something we were just talking about, obviously, facts and absence.
Well, have you seen the first one?
I did see the first one.
What'd you think?
Not my thing.
Are you not a musical person?
Not really.
You didn't like the allegory for... Because, you know, the original book was an anti-fascist book.
Yeah, I don't want to dig that deep on it. It's The Wizard of Oz. And this whole...
The Wizard of Oz was originally a political book. What are you talking about?
Why do I want to know that the Wicked Witch has some nice features? It's like, no, she's wicked. I don't care if she's dead. She got... Yeah, no. I didn't need that.
I didn't need that explanation. I think you missed the entire point of...
I know that they
want... It's all about propaganda.
Here's the thing that's changed in movies. They got to embed all of this other stuff instead of telling
the
story.
It's originally a book.
I understand that it was an original book.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that this was your stance. Oh, but we could get in so many fights over this.
Yes.
First of all, you know that the original Wizard of Oz is not just like a children's book, right?
Correct.
Like, it was a bigger
allegory,
like metaphor.
Absolutely.
And so, it's like, you know, Animal Farm. And thus, so is Wicked the book.
Mm-hmm.
It was an anti-fascist book. And so the themes and the... foreshadowing and all of the literary concepts in there are talking about, you know, our assumption over who is good, who gets to be told who is good, who is bad.
I know all these things, but I don't. The Wizard of Oz movie that we all grew up with was none of that, even though it was based on a book that was. And that's where a book doesn't define what a movie is. Yes, that was me talking right through the news open there. We're talking about. It's an important topic.
We got so heated over something that I had no idea we were going to talk about.
You don't understand my point?
I do understand your point. I did not realize that you do not like, in your movies and your shows, political undertones or messages that are supposed to be representative of larger issues unfolding in the world.
Unless that's the specific theme of the movie, but when you're talking about the Wizard of Oz and whatever these new versions are supposed to be, I don't need it. I want to be entertained. And I was trying to make the point before the news interrupted me, and I appreciate the news because we just talked about that, especially ABC and all of our local folks and Connie as well. I want to be entertained, and I can make a larger point if you want, because we're going to talk about something else, that... sort of this shift to make all of these political points within every movie, whether it's Barbie or whatever, these Wizard of Oz, Wicked, they're less entertaining to me.
To you.
To my generation, I could probably say. It's all anecdotal.
I would say.
For
people who are listening who are your age, I would love to hear if they also agree. It's just subjective. I just didn't realize you don't find those things entertaining, while I find them wildly entertaining.
Yeah, and I would argue that one of the things that's roiled our culture and our country is that very insertion, where everything you watch, whether it's an award show or a film or a TV, it's like all now layered with politics. And I think people are saying, hopefully, maybe I'll take a breath from that and just entertain us. That's my point. And this is what I love about the text line. Steve is right, Steve is wrong. Into text right next to each other. It's subjective, and some people love that stuff. And
now one just came in and said, Kristen is correct.
Well, there
love
you go.
Texts.
So you got one. So we're all over the place. All right. This story has got legs, and it takes us to the state of Minnesota. We're not talking about the Vikings or whatever they do or don't do. This one takes us to, and it goes back to the pandemic when funds were coming, ripping out of the federal government. And I want to be clear on this because I was a a hard, sharp critic of just unregulated funding coming out of the federal government during the pandemic. It was insane. And my famous one, which I'm going to say again, Tom Brady got a PPP loan, and a dude didn't need it, and he's never paid it back. And that's one of the many reasons I don't like Tom Brady, although he's a fantastic football player in which he played for the Packers. But come on, dude. And that sort of thing drove me nuts. What are we talking about? All of these allegations from Minnesota about how these funds and the specific funds related to, and I'm looking it up right now, the Feeding Our Future was one of the Minnesota nonprofits that was receiving federal funds for nutritional programs trying to help, which is a noble cause, serve meals to underserved children and families. But during the COVID-19 pandemic, as I said then, and I'm going to say again now, the regulations, restrictions went out the window. Money came out, funds came out, and fraud happened. And this story in Minnesota has serious legs. And we're just talking about non-traditional journalists. That's what's sort of driving
this. So this is what happened over the Christmas break. And so I kind of missed it because I decided to shut it down over Christmas the last couple of days. We really didn't cover, like we said, a ton of news last week. But Nick Shirley, who I had never heard of before, but similar, who's the who's the Milwaukee guy who did the Kia Boys documentary?
I forgot the name.
Tommy something. So it's similar to that, where he's a YouTube independent journalist who goes in with his cameras and kind of like guerrilla style filming. And so I had not heard of this guy before. He is a Trump ally, over a million followers on YouTube. So it blew up over the last couple of days because he went and did a 45-minute expose and just went to a lot of these different Somali-owned daycare centers and places that had on the books received a lot of money. And so here's a little bit of a clip from Fox and Friends of snippets from that YouTube documentary.
So this is Quality Learning Center. I meant to say Quality Learning Center. We've arrived to ABC Learning Center. All the windows are blacked out. I would like to check a child in the daycare.
Why?
Can I speak to a manager? I would like to see if I could bring little Joey, my son, little Joey here. Is there a paperwork? Can I check out the daycare?
You got $2.66 million this year in funding and $2.5 million last year. We're just wondering where the kids are.
Hello, we'd like to ask where the money's going.
So this, I mean, obviously, he has the FBI. Cash Patel has responded to this. It has tens of millions of views online, and this video is helping thrust this issue into the mainstream. As far as it's been bubbling, but now I feel like it's unavoidable. As far as, like we said, other news outlets having to start to dig deeper into this and start to put the pieces together.
I don't want to just rely on him, surely, because this is an actual case. A federal prosecutor, Joe Thompson, first assistant U.S. attorney for Minnesota. There's $9 billion of funds that are sort of unsupported, that are just out there that, you know, that's a lot of money. These things have been going on even pre-pandemic, which is also scary. And something I've been critical of the government before, they run these programs that they don't critically assess whether they work one and two, whether they're administered efficiently. And all this stuff is significant because of this other piece, which we know that the president has been extremely critical, and others, of the Somali population in Minnesota. I used to work in St. Paul, did it for almost 20 years, back and forth between here and St. Paul, Minnesota. You can't go to that Twin Cities area without recognizing the Somali population. And I'm not here to ostracize them or to criticize them in general. But when you look at the actual specifics of this case brought by the U.S. attorney for Minnesota, it can't get past this. 82 of the 92 defendants are Somali. And if you don't know this factoid, largest Somali population in the U.S. is in the Twin Cities. It is somewhat remarkable that sort of stamp by one group within this subject of fraud, in this case, misuse of government funds. It's stunning, and it's sort of, I don't like the fact that it's now pointing a finger at one group, because that's not a healthy way to live our lives.
So if there's let's say there's in total 100 people implicated, how many people does 100 Somalis represent of the entire Somali population in the Twin Cities?
Well, whatever 100 is of 101,000. So whatever that is.
So
yeah,
a small percentage. And so,
but still, it's the majority of that.
I mean, this it depends. Where do you want to take this conversation? Because I would say, is this the same conversation whenever we talk about the recipients of different welfare programs? Predominantly, like the stereotype that most of us come up with our brain because we've been media has trained us to think this way is usually the black population. What population is actually the biggest recipient of welfare funds? White people. If we had to look into fraud cases in throughout history, throughout the last 10 years, who do you think's actually probably committed the most like SEC fraud?
Yeah, probably white people. We're not talking about the recipients. We're talking about the administrators of these programs. That's the one subtle difference here. Yeah. I'm sure the recipients of these programs are not Somali. They're probably a broad representation of what the demographics are in the state of Minnesota. But the actual administrators of these apparently fraud-filled programs are generally, well, the number's 89% of the defendants charged. Many of these people have already pled guilty and are convicted. So that's the other piece of this. This is not a question mark. This has already happened for a lot of these people. These are real cases.
No, I understand that they're real cases. That's not the argument. The reason why this is a bigger story is because, like most big stories, there's lots of layers to it. There is the political layer as far as just Tim Walz in general being a target from Republicans as far as how he...
Sure.
How he acts, things that he's said.
It's
the fact that he's up for re-election, which on its face, he probably should not run again. But so there is that aspect of it. There is the immigration piece of it in general. And like anytime you can scapegoat a group. And then there is also the fact that in general, because this group of people who happens to all be from the same group did a very bad thing, doesn't and shouldn't demonize an entire population.
That's why I led off with that, because I don't want to demonize Somalis.
And so that's why I make the point as far as when we look at things that white people do in much bigger numbers, because so far we are the majority, we never get lumped as, well, there's something wrong with white people.
Yes, I don't want to make that argument.
The argument
I'm making is there are astronomical levels of fraud built into many of these programs across this country. Here's just one example. When we sort of willy-nilly sent trillions of dollars, what was it, $5 trillion during the pandemic to individuals, to companies, small business and otherwise, and to organizations like this, there really was very little sort of overview, oversights. And here's the other unsettling part. There wasn't even post-review on many of these things. And here's the other piece that's scary, and this is on this administration. There's 9% less government employees right now. Who's doing the oversight? We have 9% less people that might have been tasked with doing this oversight who are not even in those jobs anymore. Fraud is horrific in the federal government. It's why we can never get a handle on our budgets. It's why we continue to have problems in our country, because we spend money that should not be spent. That's my overall point with this. Whether it's Somalis doing it, whether it's white people, whether it's pick a group. I don't care. It's fraud. And in this case, I think it's already been proven, because they've either pled guilty or been convicted. They're guilty of this. So full hammer of the law has to come down on these people. And this is $9 billion out of $5
trillion.
Well,
do we know the actual number? Because as I was trying to read up on this morning and get up to speed, it feels like there's how much actual money was stolen has not been clarified yet.
This is what the U.S. Attorney for Minnesota is reporting. So okay. I'll trust the U.S. Attorney, because he would know better than I would know. Let's take a quick break. She's Chris and I'm Steve's Point Taken on this Monday edition on 620 WTMJ. We are talking about fraud in the state of Minnesota. And I'm not, you know, as much as I pick on Minnesota because they have that horrible football team and franchise, it's not unique to Minnesota. It's everywhere. And, you know, we may see some investigations into Wisconsin, how those funds were spent. And I would not be surprised if every state. And I was telling Krista before the show, I talked about it once on the program during the pandemic. In two cases, and this is not unique to me, some other people that work here, and I think at least one elected official in the state of Wisconsin, someone tried to get unemployment funds in my name in other states. I got the paperwork. I'm like, what is this? I had to call those states. I had to go through the process of saying, this is not real. That's what was happening during that pandemic, how crazy it was. People just grabbing at funds that were available, in that case, unemployment funds. But all of these other systems for supposedly helping people were, I think, so ripe for abuse. One of the texters reminded me that I had a conversation with the former Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner about that. And he said at the time, man, I'm worried about this because money's just going out the door and with no accountability.
This is a question that I don't have an answer to, but it's a legit question. Because everyone I've ever talked to who is legitimately receiving, whether it's SNAP benefits, unemployment, different programs set up when you are having a hard time. Talk about how much documentation you have to show in order to get those funds, right? Like, they don't make it easy for you when you are in need of accessing public money like that. So the question for me is, for the people who, why is it so hard and so convoluted for people who legitimately need it? And yet, is it just that the people who are committing this fraud are attuned into how to navigate the system? And so, like, for them, it's that much easier to take advantage of it than it is for the average person to even to get what they're entitled to?
Yeah, the latter. Let me give you this example. We know, because we're educated about it all the time, there's so many ways that we can be scammed. But yet these things are exploding because they're experts on scamming.
But that's us as individuals. Like, is that
every business is just individuals? It's just a few people running the company. They submit their forms. They learn how to craft these forms, at least the part they fill in, to sort of say, "Oh, this is a legitimate organization. Let's send them $600 million or $5 million from large to small." And I think we are so accustomed to seeing that form of government here that we don't have critical analysis anymore. And I said it before, and I'll say it again. The scary part for me is we have less people at the government, 9% less federal employees at the end of this year than we had at the beginning, that are tasked with fighting this fraud. Anybody think it's going to get better? It's literally going to be up to states, and maybe Minnesota's doing it the right way. Maybe they're using their U.S. attorney and their other AG to find the fraud. Maybe that's the way which we all the states should go. And maybe that's the answer to all these questions. Maybe we rely too much on the federal government. Maybe our state government, our state law enforcement, our state legal experts and minds, from AG to U.S. attorneys, maybe they have to do the heavy lifting to find the fraud. And maybe that's a good thing. But again, I'm not a lawyer. So when I see something like $9 billion going out the door with, and they can't even identify themselves as a real child care center. And here's the, you know, the kicker that we played. They spelt learning wrong on their sign. And that passed for a while. I mean, come on.
Pretty bad.
That's pretty bad.
All right. Dave Spano's gonna be with us.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
What the heck's going on with silver? If you have silver right now, you should hold on to it. So we're gonna start there as far as Dave explaining why there is a squeeze on silver and lots of other predictions for 2026. So stay with us on Point Taken.
The work week is here. Let's begin with your Monday market preview with Annex Wealth Management CEO Dave Spano on Point Taken.
Indeed. For the last time in 2025, Dave Spano joins us, maybe for some more predictions of what's coming in 2026. But first, Dave, I have a question for you that I first have a story to go with it. So are you, Dave, are you diversified at all in collectibles?
Exposure, and I have it through some exchange-traded funds.
Okay.
But so I don't have physical collectibles.
So you're not like going to card shows and buying some cards or Pokemon cards or anything like that?
Nope, no Pokemon cards for
this
guy.
So my husband loves collectibles. He has a lot invested in there. So he lives on eBay. And over the weekend, he got very excited because he saw how much silver was surging. And he found someone on eBay who had tons of silver coins and had not adjusted the price accordingly. So overnight, he bought a bunch of silver coins only to have that order canceled by the time everyone woke up the next morning. So I say that only to ask you, what happened with silver over the weekend?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I used to have some collectibles. I had some baseball cards, you know, from 40 years ago that I think I put them in my bike and, you know, just kind of ruined them, but there were some good ones. I'm just kidding. So, yeah, you see what happened with silver, and really what's been happening for some time is metals have really had a rally. In fact, throughout the year, silver, it wasn't just last night, silver's up well over 100% year to date. But what's been happening is some of these precious metals are being purchased by a number of institutions, one of them being China. And so China is looking at some of these, because silver actually has an actual institutional use. And so they can use them for a number of reasons. But if you look at really what's happening, and you know, you saw silver just spike about 6% or so. But part of it is you can see where it's happening. In Shanghai, for example, is going up a lot higher than what's happening in London. So you can kind of follow the money and see what's happening. But everything that goes into this, Christian, including, you know, rate cuts and the Fed and the debt in this country, are pushing people to metals, both gold and silver, and they do trade in a similar range.
Dave, one of the big stories, of course, of 2025 was the institution of tariffs across the board, many, many international agreements with many countries. And one of the arguments against the president doing what he did, and this is obviously going to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court at some point in 2026, is that it was going to shock the system. But one of the expectations was that. But the reality is there has been less or fewer tariff shocks than a lot of people expected. Why do you think that is?
Well, part of it is, you know, you'll remember that probably a year ago or so, I said it is going to be a temporary inflation shock. It's not a permanent inflation shock. So how do you create inflation? You know, one of the big ways is monetary policy, because that's a more permanent and lasting, where a tariff is more of a immediate shock, and then it kind of levels out. And so most economists were wrong that this was going to cause runaway inflation, and that has not happened, because you put the price on, and then they paid the tariff, and then the customer pays it, whoever, you know, however it's paid. Either the customer pays it, the company pays it somehow, the country pays it, and then that causes a one-time price spike. And when that doesn't stick, that is one of the big reasons why. So we did see that tariffs were more temporary, but that doesn't mean it's not inflationary. You'll recall our conversation from a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I said it is inflationary. It's just not permanent inflation like loose monetary policy.
So where do you think inflation goes in 2026? Obviously, we've had three Fed cuts for interest rates. Unclear what's going to happen in January. But where do you think, and also, because I think this is where a lot of us always get confused as far as the term inflation versus the actual price of things. And so when we're measuring what the inflation rate is versus prices actually coming down, where do you see those two things going next year?
By the way, Kristen, that is such a good point. I know we pound the table on that, but let's just start with the second piece. And when people see, well, inflation came down, but they go to the store and they didn't see prices come down, they don't connect those two pieces. Inflation is the rate of change. So if the rate of change a couple years ago was 9, 8, 7%, and now it's 2 or 3%, they forget that prices aren't coming down. It's just that they're not going up as much. And that's really what inflation is. And you can go back, you know, decades and see that the average inflation rate has been about 3 to 4%. So the Federal Reserve has really kind of put this target out there that they want to get to 2%. So it's in the twos right now. But the Fed, again, is going to get challenged because they have these two jobs, these dual mandates, and they're going to have a job mandate and they're going to have an inflation mandate. And because they're close to their inflation target, you know, at high twos right now, do they get it to 2%, or do they worry about their other job, which is jobs? And that is really where their source is probably going to go, because it did look like unemployment rate continues to tick up, now over 4%, 4.something percent, and that is going up, and that is going to get their attention. So do they lower rates to keep the job market going, which then fuels inflation, right? So they're in a pickle at the moment between first and second base. So which way do they go? Do they worry about jobs because job growth is slowing, and then they take their eye off of inflation? So the Fed is in a predicament. They probably are going to continue to lower rates. That's probably if Kevin Hassett becomes the new Fed chair. We'll find out shortly. If that happens and they lower rates, that could spur on inflation while trying to get jobs going. So it's not going to be a clear path, but we're going to watch it closely because, you know, it's going to be a bumpy ride. But do they get to a low 2%? Probably. And by the way, there's a lot of good stuff happening next year, Kristen. We've got in 2026, you've got, you know, some of the tax refunds are coming. You've got looser monetary policy. You've got the projection for economic gains in the United States, something over 4 to somewhere near 5% GDP growth. And companies are reporting that they're going to have something in the neighborhood in general, of about 10% growth. So that all could create an inflation problem while not adding jobs. That's going to be a predicament.
Dave doing his own tease. We'll take a quick break here with Dave Spano from Annex Wealth Management. Great place to get started, annexwealth.com. Click on that now famous Get Started button. What are the public thinking? What's the public thinking about? Where are the storylines for financial planning and the economy and all the things Dave just talked about next year? So we'll tease all of that with Dave after this on 620 WTMJ. Dave Spano, CEO of Annex Wealth Management, annexwealth.com. Great place to get started. Dave, we teased it a little bit before the break here on Point Taken, but think about the public, the perception of all of us, and perception is a big word, and it certainly is. It plays into where the markets go, where people, what they do with their money, how they financial plan, all of those things. What's some of the things that people should be thinking about as they approach the new year, their financial planning, and sort of all things economic in 2026?
Yeah, you know, you nailed it, right? It's perception. So people look at their economics and the economy of the United States, unfortunately, through the optics of politics. And so we have put together a balance sheet. So we've put the, one side, we put all the things that are good, the assets. And on the other side, we put all the things that are liabilities. And as we talk to folks, we say, how do you think about these things? And if people are against the current administration, they like to focus on the liabilities. And if they're for the current administration, whatever it is, they kind of focus on the assets. So you want to start on the negative side or the positive side?
Let's go negative first and positive.
All right. Okay. So let's just start on the liability side. So right now you can argue that the valuations are super high, that part of these companies are trading ahead of their fundamentals. So that's one, and they go, well, the market is overpriced. Number two, you can talk about, where is the geopolitical risk, especially between war and peace? You know, are you going to see something, better around the world than we have today? And just pick on, the Venezuelan situation today, of course, Ukraine, Russia, China, all of those things. You go to move to, we moved away from a free trade to more of a protectionist type of economy. And so if you look at that's a negative. Of course, you can pick on the administration and the uncertainty that comes out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And, of course, the dollar continues to weaken. The biggest one that I focus in on, and it's not much that we can do about it, are demographics. So the demographics of this country are clearly changing. You know, I begin to think about where all the money is, and Kristen, you and I often talk about the K-shaped economy, and that is because of demographics, that the baby boomers control, three-quarters of the assets of the country, sometimes even more than that. And so as they shift and as this country ages, what happens to the jobs that are out there? And, of course, that's sentiment. But then as a positive-type person, I like to focus on all the positives, guys. I think about the economic growth that's in front of us, something maybe a 5% GDP. If it begins with a 5 handle, that's going to be really good for the country. As I mentioned, there's profit and growth that is coming. There's a lot of liquidity between what's going to happen from the big, beautiful bill, that people are going to get tax refunds, that monetary policy will continue to get probably even looser than it is right now. Oil prices are coming down. Inflation is stabilizing. So all of that is going to be an interesting year, but the big uncertainty is what's going to happen with the election this coming year, because that generally in a midterm election causes volatility, especially after July 4th and up until the election.
So as far as what do you think people are underestimating and the positives?
I think people are underestimating what AI could do in the positive, right? People are afraid that, that it's going to replace a lot of jobs, and it may. But if you want to look at it in the positive, you want to look at how it's going to make people more productive. And I think we've seen this story before. Go back to, the tech boom and bust in the early late 1990s. That really made people more productive, right? Think about what you can do on your computers now that you couldn't do 25 years ago. when that tech boom happens. So I do think people are underestimating the good things that could come out of AI, but the bad side is I think people are overestimating the boom in some of these tech stocks because they may not see the fruits of this until maybe 4 or 5 years from now.
All right. Well, one last thing before I know I'll do the part that you won't do. So good advice. Go to annexwealth.com, click on the now famous Get Started button. But beyond that, the one piece of advice you would just say to people as you approach the end of this year, approaching next year, obviously, with all the things you just talked about, what's that piece of advice?
Yeah. I think it really, and I think we do that as people in the media, is we talk to everybody. Like sometimes you'll see a magazine when you go to Walgreens and it says, this is what you should do now, right? People's circumstances are different. So the one piece of advice, if you're just getting going, is number one, reduce your debt. Is don't get over your skis in the amount of debt that you have, either be credit card debt or whatever it is. And then to go along with that is save. Put money into your 401k plan. Make sure that you have a rainy day fund. You know, to have half of America that cannot pay for $1,000 incident right now is not good. But if your audience is somebody who is past that, for sure, do your tax and estate planning and make sure it's talking to your investment plan. That's the most important thing. I'm telling you, even my friends and in my social circle, I hear people say, yeah, you know, I've got a tax. I did my estate plan back when the kids were in school. My money is here, there, and everywhere. Put it all together. Make sure it's talking together. That would be a goal for 2026.
Interesting you brought that up because it's the one thing when people talk about your appearances or the fact that we talk about these things on our show is they always say they don't have a will or an estate plan. It's like, what are you waiting for? Especially when they're my age. Like, none of this stuff gets easier if you don't have one. So it's like the best gift you
can give to your living relatives.
One of the best lessons we got when we signed on with Annex is we got those things in place. And that's, trust me, it's a great
it just
way
happened,
to start.
Steve. And I didn't mean to jump in, but this just happened the other day to a friend of mine, you know, looked relatively healthy, had bypass surgery, right? Mm. And so these things can happen if your estate plan isn't in order or your estate has changed, right? Your kids are grown, whatever, you have grandkids. If your circumstances have changed, now is the time to do that. Sorry for interrupting there.
No problem. Absolutely. All right, Dave, always a fun conversation. Thanks for sharing your wisdom. AnnexWealth.com, great place to start. Have a wonderful New Year's Eve. We'll talk to you on the flip side.
Talk to you in 2026.
Okay. Happy New Year. Thanks.
All right. Happy New Year. Dave Spano.
Happy New Year.
All right. Take a quick break here. Lots more to get to in our remaining 35 minutes on Point Taken on 620 WTMJ. Minute and a half away from the ABC News update and our local news with Connie Weber. Happy New Year, Connie Weber, in advance. This was on our outline, and we talked about Epstein a lot in 2025, and I don't want to spend more than this, but I just...
Oh, you don't want to spend any more than this?
This 1 minute and a half right now,
because
we're going to get to other things on tomorrow's and Wednesday's show. But to me, the significance of the Epstein case won't be known for years, probably past this administration.
I also, earlier in the show today, we were talking about the flood versus the drought.
Right.
And I feel like, because we didn't talk about it at all last week, with this Epstein Transparency Act and the flood of every document that some is fake, some is unsubstantiated, like it's just now, like no one is going to be happy because here's everything and you don't know what's real, what's not, and no one actually feels satisfied with kind of the unleashing of all this information. And it's just a mess.
Until it's researched and parsed out, again, years from now, maybe there's some legal cases, I don't know. But I do know this. One of the impacts of having a administration that's less sophisticated and less staffed in some of these critical areas of review, we've seen files that were supposed to be redacted be simply unredacted because they didn't know what they were doing.
You know what it was? It wasn't even that they didn't know what they were doing. It's that they canceled their Adobe Premiere. So you need to have the higher echelon of Adobe subscription to redact things appropriately. And because Doge cut subscriptions across the board, they didn't have Adobe Premiere and thus could not redact appropriately without people just being able to cut and paste and actually see what was in those files.
And I'll take credit because I said Doge is a mistake when the way they approached it, and I'm still 100% right. All right. All right, let's get to it. I broadcast on ESPN 94.5 and 620 WTMJ pregame, Packers game day, along with Alex Stroph and Gabe Neitzel. And we had a fun pregame, as we always do at the Tundra Trio. And always thanks to those guys and ESPN 94.5 for inviting me. But that game, I was just telling you during the break, obviously I'm a Packers fan, grew up a Packers fan, lived through the end of the Lombardi era. I was that old. And
you also lived through a lot of years, I didn't have to live through of when they were not very good.
Yeah, the 70s and 80s. And then, of course, it all changed. Ron Wolf and Brett Favre and all of that. And then, of course, Aaron Rodgers and now Jordan Love. But they're so infuriating to watch. They're so inconsistent. And you made a great point about Malik Willis.
He played so well.
Out of his mind.
Here's my question. Do you think he stays next year? No. I mean, he's now been able to demonstrate how good he actually is. And, like, we don't have the money to keep him. Our money's tied up in Parsons and Love. Yeah. And so I know he said he loves Green Bay and doesn't want to leave and it's not about the money. And I know that video of him after the combine went viral again of when he was giving like water and clothes to a homeless person. It's like, oh, and on top of it, you're also just a really good person. Like, oh.
So somebody sent me this somewhat scary thought is he's going to be he's going to cash. He's not going to cash $50 million, but he could cash $20 million per season. And one of the places he could show up is Minnesota.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're a pipeline for they have Aaron Jones. They've had, you know, our kickers over the year. So that's a connection I don't want to see. And I have mad respect for what Malik Willis did in that game. Yeah. But the maddening part for me as a Packers fan is every week a part of the team either doesn't show up, in this case it was defense, or special teams the week before. Obviously, the thing that handed the Chicago Bears the NFC North title, a kick that should have been handled by Romeo Doubs. Or it's a team that plays brilliantly, i.e. the second half of the Steelers game early in the year where they just scored like 28 points and blew them off the map in Pittsburgh. But first half, nothing. The inconsistency is a reason why I've been very critical of their coach, Matt LaFleur. Now, as I said on Saturday, Matt LaFleur is a good coach. He's not a great coach because he's not had great postseason success. And he's, as I said, infuriating to watch coach this year because he's been inconsistent. He seems
You think
unable.
The coaching's inconsistent, not the playing.
I think all of it is inconsistent. But to me, and I made this point with Alex and Gabe on Saturday, coaches are responsible for the performance and the conduct of their players on the field. And man, oh man, oh man, throughout this season and probably a few more seasons going back to when Matt LaFleur started 6-7 years ago, there seems to be some disconnect there where we are seeing this inconsistency play out, and certainly in the rather upsetting trend now that when they do make the playoffs, they either don't have a home playoff game, which is a big deal for those of us who are season ticket holders, obviously, or if they have a home game, they lose it. Since they were 13-0 up until the end of the McCarthy era at home at Lambeau in the playoffs. Since that moment when they lost the game to Atlanta all those years ago, they're 7-7 at home in the playoffs.
That's
not a great record for the last two coaches of the Green Bay Packers. It's not. And the standard is high. They call it Title Town for a reason. I know people make fun of it. And the other part, real quickly, because I'd love to hear what your thoughts on some of this is.
I also have a really, in the next segment, a better feeling Packer story.
This idea that now the opponents of the whatever, you know, of the teams, of the opponents of us, of the Green Bay Packers and the fans, are mocking us in our own stadium with these cheese grater things.
Well, you know
the
story behind that, right?
I do.
If people are unfamiliar, so if you watched the Packer game on Saturday night and you saw the cheese grater hat, it's because, so one of the guys, if not the guy who was making cheese heads, the Packers took over, like sent a cease and desist, and no one but the Packers are now allowed to make cheese heads anymore.
Right.
So this guy, you know, lifelong Packers fan, but was like, a business is a business, started making, the former maker of cheese heads is now making these cheese grater hats and selling them to opponent fans and now apparently players as well. And so it's hard to, you know, the Packers maybe just should have let people make cheese heads.
Yeah, maybe. And now that we're being openly mocked in our own stadium and, of course, all over the world now with these cheese grater things, look, I'm not saying Matt LaFleur should be fired. I'm saying there should be some changes on his coaching staff, and maybe that's a decision that had policy that now the new Packers president will have to make. But if there's a very underwhelming performance by this team, the Green Bay Packers, in the playoffs, where they get blown out, nothing would surprise me. Because that's not acceptable to this organization.
Well, I assume that, I mean, now that, because this next, the Vikings game doesn't change anything, right?
Meaningless.
Winning or losing. So I would imagine, no, everyone's going to sit out. Everyone's going to take the week to rest. And so we can't really expect much for this next game. And then we go in as the wild card and we'll see what happens.
To a degree, you're right. But this, embarrassed in the second half in Denver. We all know what happened in Chicago. Defensive, as bad as it gets for the defense of the Packers this week. If they're embarrassed in Minnesota, even though it's a meaningless game, and then you add an embarrassment in the playoffs, those things all stack together as, what, five consecutive losses? That's not a good look for any coach, let alone Matt LaFleur. Quick break. Kristen, Steve, point taken on 620 WTMJ.
Well, welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. He is Steve Scafidi. And we were lamenting Packers loss, but we're going to move on because what else is there to say?
Oh, Alex Troche was supposed to join us, but he had a commitment that he could not get out of. So he'll be here along the way as we go through the playoffs, however long that goes.
All right. Have you ever received a cameo?
No.
Do you know what they are? So for people unfamiliar with what cameo is, it's different celebrities, high profile people who make themselves available on this platform called Cameo. They set their rate and then they can send you a personalized video. I have never received one. Sometimes it's the butt of a joke of people, you know, willing to for $200, $300, you know, but it, you know, for them, it's an easy way to make some money. Sometimes you see them, saying things you would not expect people to say. Like I've seen Omarosa do one before. But my brother had this idea to do a cameo with Brett Favre for our parents.
He does a lot of them.
And, you know, and I think it was one of those things that he's like, what do you think? And I was like, you know what? Actually, I think my parents would appreciate that because no matter what, who Brett Favre became and what you think of him now, those years, as you can attest to, I was too young to appreciate it, but those years of Reggie White coming and then in Brett Favre coming and that turnaround team. And then I was alive and like, I think I was 10 when we went to the Super Bowl the first time. And so, and my mother's connection to her mom who died when I was 6, who was a huge Packers fan, who I remember the entire time I grew up, my mom always saying, you know, when Brett Favre first got to the Packers, grandma would always say, I think he's going to be really good for us. And so my brother went ahead and did it. And so we now have, and he's played it for my parents on Christmas over the weekend. And, you know, he starts Devin Pete and goes into, and he met, because there's a character limit, my brother wrote B-ball. So he says to my dad, he goes, you know, Pete, you played for UW. I'm not sure if it was basketball or baseball. So I guess he didn't understand that B-ball is usually always basketball. But, and my parents were thrilled. It was very fun to see how much it meant to them to have a personalized message from someone who, no matter, like I said, no matter what you think of him now, meant so much to Packers fans in the 90s. And like the familial ties it is for my mom to her mom. And now they have this that just lives in their phone. They could share with their friends. And so I am here to say, even if you sometimes laugh at the idea of cameos, not always a bad gift.
Well, we share this because 5 years ago, Kathy's teacher friends, when she retired, got her a Brett Favre cameo.
There you go.
And he was awesome. He was funny. They fill in the details about her retirement.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was awesome. It reminded me that I should go back and look at that because he was really, really good in it.
This one, I think you can tell some of the Parkinson's stuff is happening.
Which he's suffering from, yeah.
Which, you know, he has. And but it was still very cool. It was unexpected as far as how much it meant to my parents. So.
Right, so my question for you is, if you were gifted one of these things, who would you want your cameo to be from?
I'm not enough of a...
It doesn't have to be sports. It could be anything.
I know.
For me, it'd be fun if Trump did one for me, because I'd love to hear what that sounded
like. That would
be
funny if Trump
like.
Did one for you. I would say one of the few times I've actually gotten, like, when I was working in L.A., this, and she's really out of the news now, but one of the times that I really got, when I worked at a sushi restaurant in the Pacific Palisades, And as we now know, because of the fires almost a year ago, a lot of celebrities live in Pacific Palisades, and this was also the only bar in town. So we had a lot of different people that would come through, even though it was kind of a family restaurant. Gina Davis came in once.
Oh, yeah.
And I think between A League of Their Own, how much she's done for women in media, how smart she is, and she was so nice in person. Not that I would want a cameo from her, but that was one of the only times I was a little starstruck. I don't know. Who would you think Trump would be yours?
Yeah, it'd be fun, if nothing else, because you're giving him some information about you, and he probably would. Maybe he wouldn't.
It'd probably be funny.
He'd have fun with it. Yeah. Should we do cameos for other people?
Do you think anyone would pay for them?
Somebody asked me once. Not actually more than once. This is a couple of years ago. If I would do one for them, I go, I'm not doing that for pay.
Would you do it for free?
Absolutely.
I would do it. See, that's the thing. I feel like where I'm at in life, this is me as like the actor brain. Like growing up acting and how many times I've auditioned for things and never been cast. Like it is so instilled in me that whenever anyone asks me to do something, my initial reaction is like, really? Me?
Yeah.
Which is why it's impossible for me to ever say no.
I mean, I'm a guy that did one year for, I think it was Best Buddies, might have been WTMJ.
You did all those Singing Valentine's,
I did Singing,
right?
Valentine's. Yeah. I did like 50 of them. And I, you know, as much as I think I might be a singer, the range required for some of these songs was ridiculous. I know Bill Stead likes to play it every once in a while, me trying to sing a Journey song or something.
Yeah, so I feel like where I'm at in my life, I would do it for free if anyone would ask, because I'd just be so flattered that anyone would want me to do it.
All right, since some of the texters are sending in their ideas, who would your cameo request be to? And tell me maybe why that is. Texter says, George Strait, awesome artist.
Ah.
Great.
All right, I'll try
voice.
To think of one during the break. But yeah, if you have, who would you want a cameo from,
yeah,
if someone were to buy it for you? 855-616-1620. And we'll be back to finish up today's show after this. All right, as we wrap up this Monday show of Point Taken, I told the story that my brother had the idea of giving a Brett Favre cameo to my parents for Christmas, and it was very well received. And then we're asking, who would you get a cameo from if you would, if you had your choice? Not that necessarily that these people are on Cameo, because obviously there's a lot of people who are not that are famous. But we had, this is actually a great idea. Someone from the 414 said, we get a Santa cameo every year, and it's worth its weight in gold. Keeps the magic alive for our youngest.
Nice.
That's a really good one.
A lot of music ones.
Yeah, Lady we have
Gaga,
a George Strait.
I didn't think of Springsteen. That'd be a good one.
Yeah, too. Bruce Springsteen would be a good one for you.
Hey,
Bon Jovi.
Steve, how you doing?
So the one that I thought of for myself is, I was not, like, I was, as a young millennial, I was not, like, obsessed with NSYNC or Backstreet Boys or Jonathan Taylor Thomas. Like, all of the kind of that age of teen bop or whatever, the guys who were on the cover of those girly magazines. But I did have one celebrity crush when I was in eighth grade, and I will say I was certainly pretty obsessed with him, and it's so it was Josh Hartnett. He was in, well, I fell in love with him during the show The Faculty, which Jon Stewart was randomly in. It's like an alien weird move, like high school movie. And then he was, his big blockbuster, he was in Pearl Harbor with Ben Affleck. But and he's done a lot of things over the years. But I loved Josh Hartnett when I was in eighth grade. I don't know why. I don't know how to explain it. But I feel like that would be a funny one for me. If someone bought me a Josh Hartnett to take me back to eighth grade Kristen and my heartthrob.
Just thought of another one because you mentioned celebrity. Heather Graham, cameo from her.
Oh, Wisconsin Connection.
Love that. Yeah, absolutely. Heather Graham. So keep those coming in. Maybe we'll dip into that tomorrow. Some special shows next 2 days, sort of the wrap of 2025, looking ahead, the list shows. We'll find some fun stuff to weave in as well. Always great to talk to all of you. If you miss any or all of the show, WTMJ.com, great platform. And also wherever you get your podcast, Point Taken. Kristen, we'll see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
News is next, 620 WTMJ.